Hello and welcome once again to the CanonBlogger.com podcast series. You're listening to episode number 60, and on today's show, I'm going to be talking about how to make money inside of photography. I'm also going to look at the subject of social networking. I'm going to look at the value of social networking, actually. And last but not least, I'm also going to give you some free resources that you can visit on the internet to get you through this short week here in the U.S. And as always, we will finish up with a few questions and answers. And I will also share a road tip where I give you a little tip to take you through the next week of shooting. So with the agenda set for this week's podcast, we are off and running. And welcome back to CanonBlogger.com. In our first segment today, I'm going to be talking to you about how to make money in photography. And this is often a subject that comes up inside of discussions about how to monetize or how to turn a hobby into a revenue source. And a lot of people like to think about this in the way of just putting their shingle out, hanging out a shingle is what they call it, where you put a shingle out and you say, all right, I'm going to charge X amount of dollars for my services here, and this should make me some good side income. And that's all fine and dandy if you are just looking to parlay a little extra revenue to maybe buy yourself a dinner out or anything like that. But if you really are serious about making money in photography, you have to come up with a business plan. That's the big key in really transitioning a hobby into a profession, and that's to come up with a business plan. And the subject came up on a recent photography forum discussion where people were talking about what it costs to do this, what it costs to do that, and we're asking about why it costs so much sometimes to order event photography sessions from photographers. And the reason why is because there really is quite a bit of investment that goes into a photography career. And what I took the liberty of doing was compiling a different set of subjects or groups that you really can incur a lot of costs in that you have to take into account when setting prices. And the four groups that I came up with are the hourly commitment, how many hours you're going to commit to any given event. So, for example, if you're a wedding photographer, are you going to do an initial meeting to discuss contract dates, specific shots wanted, things like that? What about, and again, I'm also talking throughout this scenario about wedding photography. So first off would be an initial meeting. Did you want to account for that hour in there? What about the ceremony preparation shots? There's usually an hour involved there. The ceremony itself usually lasts about an hour. Then also immediately following a ceremony, you've got about an hour's worth of formal photos that you want to take because you want to get the bride and the bridesmaids, and then you want to get the groom and the groomsmen, and then you want to get the bride and the groom, and then you want to get the bride and the groom and the bride's parents, and then the bride and the groom's parents, and there can be many, many combinations, many, many different poses that are involved with that. So it really can take up to an hour to get all the formals done. And you never want to miss out on the formals because that is where you will see a lot of revenue if you're producing prints as a part of this wedding package or this event package. And after that comes the reception, and I've seen photographers give rates for anywhere from 4 to 6 hours of a reception time. Following the actual event itself, you need to allocate an hour or so for creating proof sheets that you can present to the client and say, here's the best shots of the bunch, which ones do you want in your package? Once they select those, you can probably allocate another 2 hours minimum to post-processing because you don't want to work up just one or two shots. You're going to have to take the time to produce easily 30 or 40 different shots so that they can pick their final ones. After that, you'll probably take at least another hour to upload your images to your fulfillment service, whether you use overnight prints or MPix or SmugMug or any other type of online community. A lot of people are using online resources, and it can take some time to go through all those image uploads, especially if you're using high-res images or high-resolution images. So that can take an hour there as well. And then last but not least, you can also easily spend an hour getting all your prints back, getting them together in a presentable fashion, and taking that final delivery to the client. So if you look at all that, that's 14 hours right there. If you have a second shooter, you can add another 4 or 5 hours onto the total hourly commitment for an event, and you're looking at close to 20 hours of a time investment. Well, 20 hours is a significant amount of time, and you don't want to sell yourself short. So that's just one area that goes into the overall cost of quoting event prices. Other areas that you want to look at will be your gear investment. How much have you invested in gear? Do you have one digital SLR? Do you have a film SLR? Have you invested in extra batteries? What about media cards? What about flashes? What about flash batteries? What about the computer that you purchased so that you can edit photos? And for that matter, what about the software you purchased that you need to use to edit photos? And if you really are going to be a professional, you're going to want to have some backup software. You're going to want to have a hardware backup solution to protect your images. Additionally, there's other costs involved, and I put all that stuff under the category of gear investments. Other things that you may want to consider are educational investments. Have you invested in any kind of professional association? Do you subscribe to any professional journals or publications? What about continuing education? Seminars that you go to, conferences that you attend, things of that nature, that all can be categorized as an educational investment. Other things that you may also consider, or other groups, are advertising investments. If you get business cards printed up, that's an expense. What if you have a website set up? There's an expense there, too. You can also be taking out ads in newspapers. You could be advertising in the telephone book. You could be doing radio advertisements or TV advertisements. Who knows where your advertising expenses would be coming from, but these are other expenses that need to be considered in the overall pricing of your event packages. And then, of course, there's other miscellaneous expenditures that you're incurring all the time that you may not realize when you're rounding out all the costs for these event services that you're starting to provide. Other services that you have to incur costs on include internet, cellular phone service. How are they going to call you? How are they going to email you? What if you need to have a meal while you're at an event and you have to run out and grab a meal for $5 to $10? What about health insurance? Say you are doing this full-time for a career, you need to start providing for your own health insurance. That's another cost that you're going to have to incur. So when you take all these things out and you consider their quality or the amount that you are putting into each event, you can see how the costs can ratchet up pretty quickly. And that's why it's important to have a business plan, because you really don't want to go into anything with your eyes wide open, or with your eyes wide shut, actually, not realizing all the amount of time and energy and expenditures that you're putting into something to get less than what you deserve out on the back end. So those are things that you really want to consider before you can even really put one foot forward toward making money in photography, either as a hobby or as a profession. Like I said, this was a spreadsheet that I had put together to share with an online community, and I did share this attachment yesterday over at the blog. So if you're interested in looking at some of the details in this spreadsheet, I would encourage you to go back to Monday's post, which I believe is titled How to Make Money in Photography, and you can download that attachment. I think the name of the attachment is Event Cost or something like that. And for most of the fields, I have formulas set up inside there, so if you want to change the original numbers that are in the first column, everything else will calculate out for you, so you can see what it actually will cost you to do any kind of event. And you can adjust the numbers as you see fit for whatever event you are going to produce for someone. But it is something to consider putting together before you start quoting rates to different clients. And that way you're going in with your eyes open and you're familiar and are addressing all the possible expenses that you're putting into things on the front end. And that will help you keep things managed and keep a good perspective on what an appropriate and an acceptable price package is. So that pretty much wraps up the subject for our first segment here on how to make money in photography. And the bottom line is to really come up with some kind of plan. You don't want to just put random prices out there and then realize you're not charging enough, you're charging too much, or you have additional expenses that you didn't account for that need to be rolled in. These are all things you want to consider before you start going off and looking at how to make money. First, you want to figure out how much money you're putting in, because if you're taking in less money than you're putting out, it's never going to be profitable for you. So the key to doing all this is to actually put together some kind of business plan. And that pretty much will wrap things out for our first segment. When we come back, I'm going to take a look at the value of social networking. Welcome back to our second segment for the Canon Blogger podcast series. In this segment, I'll be looking at the value of social networking. And this is something that has really been taking off in recent years in many industries, not just inside the photography industry. But there are many social networking sites that have cropped up in recent years, and I'm sure you've heard of many of them. These include such resources like Twitter and Facebook and MySpace, and LinkedIn is another good one that's been a more recent crop up, where you're seeing people starting to connect with one another across the web that normally would never have connected on any level, primarily because there's no way to connect with them. And the internet has provided this wonderful opportunity to socialize and network with others that share similar interests. I've mentioned in the past another site called Meetup, and that's a wonderful social networking website. And it really is becoming a great new way to find people that share similar interests to you. I think a lot of people are turning towards these venues to look for ways to connect with other people. And I would definitely encourage you to do so. Another great resource that a lot of people network through is through community forums. I've talked about photography forums in the past, and I've actually met people from various photography forums that I've participated in and become good friends with them. So the value of social networking, I really think, has come of age. People are recognizing, socializing, and getting together first online with people that share similar interests, and then moving that to in the real world where you actually already know that you've got a common bond in one particular area. So I think, like I said, the value of this has really come of age. People are recognizing it more. But there are some things to keep in mind when you are looking at these internet methods of networking with others that share similar interests. And I've talked about these in the past and touched on them briefly, but not really in this context in terms of social networking. And the reason why I'm talking about it now is because I'm seeing a lot of people turning towards social networks for professional purposes. LinkedIn is a really good example of that, where professionals, working professionals, are connecting with others that are working in the same profession, but perhaps in other industries online. And you can look at LinkedIn.com's website to see what I'm talking about there. But it really does cross many, many sectors of society. And I think the big one on LinkedIn is probably information technology. But I'm seeing other areas in there too. Graphic design, digital photography, web design, programmers, developers, things of that nature are also on there. But they all do focus around this core area of knowledge that is all tied into information technology on some level. So that's one that I've seen. And because you're connecting and socializing with others with a professional vein in mind, you want to keep that in your forefront and in your consciousness when you're interacting with others. So even though you may just think you're Twittering a brief snippet to a friend, if you have people that are following you because they're interested in what you're saying or what you're doing, you want to be presenting yourself as professionally and putting your best face forward as often as you can. I've heard a lot of instances where people are finding new gigs, new jobs, new professional connections through a lot of these social venues, so you want to make sure you're presenting yourself correctly. And that means acting professional. It doesn't mean getting onto Twitter and saying, I got hammered last night. You may want to just say something like, I'm enjoying a nice Merlot or a nice Shiraz or having a drink with my wife or having a drink with my best friends or going out with some friends for the rest of the evening. Got to get back to work later, whatever you want to say. Make sure you're presenting it in a professional manner. And that kind of ties into the second thing, which I've talked about before, and that's in writing professionally. I know we're all growing very accustomed to the LOLs and ROFLs that we see on instant messenger clients, and people are using those more and more in things like Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and even in LinkedIn and on other community forums and whatnot. And that's all fine and dandy to a point, but again, if the purpose of your social networking is to advance professional opportunities, you really want to be expressing yourself well, intelligently, and coherently. And if you're constantly using acronyms instead of real-world words and complete sentences, people might get the wrong impression. So you do want to be careful about what you say and how you say it in these social communities. Because if you say something wrong, or if you don't say things the way you really mean to, and they're misinterpreted, this could possibly lead to not getting an introduction or a job opportunity or a career path or other things that may open up for you from these social networking opportunities. So that's the second thing, is writing professionally. Last but not least, you want to always use these social networking venues like Twitter and MySpace and LinkedIn, whatever, and community forums. And you want to be using them, and remember to not always talk with your emotions, but rather talk with your brain. And what that means is you don't just pop into a community forum or a Facebook or a MySpace or even a Twitter and just start venting emotions without thinking about what you're saying. So unless you're directing a message to someone specifically, you really want to make sure you don't give the impression that you're venting or ranting or presenting an image of yourself that you later will wish you didn't, because once you put something out there, it's really, really hard to get that back. Once you put something out in the wild, you can't take it back. There's no take backs online. And that's one thing that I see a lot of people don't realize, and they'll say something inadvertently, and 10 minutes later they'll be like, oh, I shouldn't have said that, and they'll go back and try and delete it. And on Twitter, I don't think you can. I know in community forums you sometimes can. I'm not sure what the deal is with Facebook and MySpace. I haven't used those to a great extent as of yet, because to be honest, I did think that they were primarily college-type venues for collegiates to associate with one another. But they do seem to be becoming more, I guess, acceptable in the mainstream as a means of social and professional networking. So I may be looking at those in the near future. But when you're involved in these kinds of social online networking venues, you do want to make sure that you're not just putting raw emotions out there unchecked. You want to check your emotions at the door. You want to try and act professionally. You want to try and write professionally, because you never know what impressions others may be getting of you from what may seem to you like just inane and innocuous little comments. And I can speak to that specifically on a personal level from comments I've made that I have later regretted making, as I'm sure we all have. So hopefully by bringing those, and I'm not going to mention specifics here, but bringing the idea of that to the forefront, it will help others realize that it really is important how you present yourself. First impressions are lasting ones, and sometimes they can stick with you for better or for worse. So I'm not going to belittle the value of social networking, because there is a lot of value in it, but you do want to temper how you present yourself in these kinds of communities. And that's one thing I'm trying to be more aware of and trying to hopefully let others know about as well, as I see friends and family members and other working professionals using these venues to kind of let them know, hey, this is what you said, this is how it's coming across, are you sure you meant to do that? And those are three things that are always good to ask yourself before making any kind of statements in these social networking venues. This is what I want to say. These are the words that I said. Do these words really mean what I wanted to be saying? So do look at those kinds of things before presenting yourself in these communities, because it can really make the difference in other people's perceptions of you. Coming up in our last segment, I'll be taking a look at a couple of free web resources. I'm going to look at ways that you can get things for free off the internet, and ways that you can win stuff off the internet as well. So do stick around and come back for that and for the final segment, where I take a few listener questions and answers. Welcome back to our last segment for this week's episode of the Canon Blogger Podcast series. In this final segment, I'm going to be sharing with you a couple web freebies that you can pick up by visiting certain areas of the web. The first one I'm going to point you to came from Dave Cross's blog, and you can find his blog over at davecross.blogspot.com. I'll go ahead and throw a link to this in the show notes. And Dave talks about some holiday themed frames that you can get from On One Software, and in looking at what they have to offer, you can get frames from their Photo Frame 3 and Photo Frame 4 software, where they took some out in Photo Frame 4. You can go and download them for free, the ones that were in Photo Frame 3. You can download them for free and import them into Photo Frame 4. So stop over at Dave Cross's blog, davecross.blogspot.com, and you can get those legacy holiday-themed frames from previous versions of PhotoFrame for the latest iteration, all for free. Another place that you may be interested in visiting is Digital Photography Life, not only because I've talked about them before over here, but Scott Sherman and Michael Stein in their new show have two super cool things that they are offering for free. The first is a camera strap, and if you go to their new podcast site and listen to podcast number 2, they tell you how you can get a free camera strap from SmugMug. So go visit DP Life. Their new podcast is over at personallifemedia.com, and their podcast series is titled Digital Photography Life, Make Every Shot Count. Their second episode, they talk about how to get a free camera strap from SmugMug. And anything for free is good in my book. The other thing that they have going for free that came out in their most recent episode of their Digital Photography Life podcast series is a free full version, not just a trial version, a free full version of Photoshop Creative Suite 4. So if you listen to the podcast, they tell you at the end how you can actually win that for free. And that's like a $700, $800 piece of software. So it's worth stopping over and listening to their podcast, finding out how you can win this free stuff. And I would encourage you also to pick that up and make that one of your weekly listening pleasures, because it really is a joy and a pleasure to hear about their perspectives on everything digital photography that's going on in the world, because they really do have a lot of useful information to share. And last but not least, for the free stuff for this week's episode, I would encourage you to stop over at Popular Photography's website. They're a great magazine. They've always been a great resource. I really enjoy reading about the things that they have to offer in their magazine. They're especially useful for those that are starting out, but they're just great little reminders of how to do different things and things to keep in mind whenever you go out shooting. And we can always stand to have some reminders. But Popular Photography also always has several opportunities for contests. And this month, they've got quite a few contests that are linked off their website, where you can not only win money, but you can win prizes and a whole bunch more. The first one is their monthly contest, and they call this your Best Shot Series. And they'll take the best shot from all their contributing participants, and that person will win $300. So that's a good contest to participate in regularly, because that will also help you keep looking for your best shots. A couple other contests that they have going on are the American Photo Images of the Year. It's a call for entries. They've also got the Popular Photography Annual Reader Photo Contest with its current call for entries. And last but not least, they have the 2008 Digital Wizard Contest going on. And what the last contest does is they give you 6 or 7 or 8 images, I think, to choose from. And you have to do a digital composite of 3 or 4 of them, or 2 or 3, or whatever the rules are. It's a great way to flex your Photoshop muscle or your graphic design muscle in blending multiple photos together to create a digital composite. And there's some really excellent prizes there as well. So if you go over to Poppy Photography's website, and their website is popphoto.com, popphoto.com, and follow the link to contests, you can see links to all of these things that are going on right now. Great opportunities. A lot of them are free. Some of them I know you do have to pay for the cost of entry, but I know your best shot is always a free opportunity to submit your images for consideration. So do stop in and look at those. And in rounding things out this week, I will come back briefly in just another 30 seconds or so with some questions from listeners. And I've set up a new email address, so if you're interested in getting some questions answered here at the Canon Blogger Podcast, you can send me an email to questions@canonblogger.com, and I'll take them on a first-come, first-serve basis. So stay tuned for the 3 questions and my road tip for the week. I'd like to welcome everybody back to this final segment inside the Canon Blogger Podcast series, episode number 60. And this is always the fun part because this is where I answer listener emails. And I do want to encourage everyone to participate in this last segment by sending me emails, or you can also send me your questions in the comments section of the blog. So if you go to www.canonblogger.com, you can share your questions in the comment section, and I do try and answer every comment question with an answer, and you can get the direct feedback in the comment section, or if you'd prefer an email response, I can send you an email, and I will also usually share those questions during the weekly podcast. So if you'd like to hear your question answered live within a podcast, feel free to send me an email or share it in the comment section, and I can do it there as well. So send those to questions@canonblogger.com, Q-U-E-S-T-I-O-N-S @canonblogger.com. So starting things off, I got an email from Marcus. This was about a week and a half ago, I think you wrote in. And he wrote in and said, "Hey, Jason, when you are out shooting, do you usually have a vision for what you want to shoot, or do you just look around for something to capture your interest?" First off, let me say thank you to Marcus. I think this is an awesome question. It's an excellent, excellent question, primarily because at its root, it's basically asking about where we find inspiration. And for me, the answer to that question is, well, that it varies. And it varies because if I have a specific project in mind, then my senses, my vision will be naturally focused towards that project, so I'll be attuned to finding images that are appropriate for that project. And the case in point is a little photo gallery I put together for the blog called Colors and Textures. And I wanted to wait until I had at least 12 images put together to put this gallery out there. And once I got that completed, I went ahead and did that. And now whenever I see a color or a texture that captures my eye, I will try to take a picture of that to post that to that photo gallery. So, and if you're interested in looking at that photo gallery, stop over to the blog at canonblogger.com, and you can see the Colors and Textures photo gallery linked off the top header image. So that's how it usually works for me when I've got a specific project in mind. Now, if nothing happens to be on my creative plate, usually what I will do is I'll just keep my eye open, and usually some splash of color or some interesting angle of light will catch my eye, and I'll go ahead and try and figure out how to capture that in a a digital image or in a photograph that really expresses what I need, what I'm seeing before me. So that's pretty much how I approach things if I don't have anything on my creative plate. I think probably more what Marcus was asking about here, though, is what if you don't have any inspiration or that you're not finding anything on your creative plate, no matter how hard you try? And this is why this is such a great question, because this also gives us an opportunity to both be introspective and also to look at the works of others. Because if you look at the works of others, that will stimulate your brain into seeing things from a creative perspective. It doesn't have to be your creative perspective. It can be any creative perspective. So if you're looking at the works of others, you can do it in online photo galleries. You can go to Flickr and look at the top contributions for the day or the week or the month. Or you can just do a search for whatever you know that will always catch your eye. For me, sunsets and sunrises always seem to capture me for some reason, and I'm always very fascinated by the nuances of colors and shades and tones that are associated with those events. So those always have been very attractive things for me. And I always try and capture sunsets and sunrises. If I happen to be in that place at that time with a camera, I will usually try and capture that. Not all of them are always worth sharing, obviously, or I would have more of them. But that's one thing that I know will always give me inspiration, is looking at things like that that I know will stimulate me creatively. And so I will go and seek out things like that. And whether it's through Flickr or other online communities like SmugMug, or even photography magazines can be a resource. Or go see a movie, because you can always see digital things and imagery inside of movies that can get your creative juices flowing. Another great resource that I actually turn to when I'm looking for creative inspiration is music. If I'm just feeling completely like I don't have any creative juices flowing at all, I'll just shut the computer off and I'll plug my iPod in and start listening to music. And usually after about 5 or 10 minutes, I'll start getting some creative juices flowing from that as well. That seems to stimulate me. And I think that stimulates a lot of people, because music does tend to be very creative, not only in its own inspiration, but it can inspire other sources of creativity as well. So, great question, Marcus. Thank you so much for writing in about that. That's a great little tip, as well as a little insight on how to get creative juices flowing. Our second email that I got in, and I think I got to this one just a few days ago, was from Krista. I'm guessing that's how I pronounce it, K-R-I-S-T-A. Krista writes in and asks about what kind of keyboard gives the best response times. And I want to also thank Krista for sharing her email. I'm guessing it's a her, because this is particularly interesting. We hear all the time about people using a mouse versus a trackball versus a trackpad or anything like that, but we're also always talking about keyboard shortcuts, and we never really hear much in the way of what keyboard works well, what keyboards don't work well. And with me, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon, because due to my vocation, which is information technology and systems administration, I usually just tend to pound away on whatever happens to be in front of me. Sometimes the keyboards are sticky, sometimes they're smooth, sometimes they're clunky, sometimes they're not responsive at all. And I usually, if I can't do something on the keyboard, I'll know a mouseable version of it, or I'll know a workaround. If one key is stuck, I can go about it with another method. So I have never really paid too much attention to the keyboard that's in front of me. But in order to answer her question, I thought I'd share with you my keyboard that I use at the house. And that is a Slimline Kensington. And I really do find that I enjoy the touch and the feel and the tactile response that the Kensington keyboards give me. The model I have at the house is the K64365. That really seems to work well. But I will also say that keyboard response times and responsiveness has a lot to do with maintenance. And periodically what I will do is I will turn off my computer and I'll pop off keys that seem to be sticking and take some canned air to them. And also at the house, I will try to avoid eating food around my keyboard so the keys don't get jammed up from crumbs of toast or anything like that. Of course, I don't do that at home. I don't do that at work as much as I should. But that can give a little insight onto what will provide the best response time on keyboard selection. That will really be a matter of personal taste, whether you like something that is very sensitive or something that isn't as sensitive. So depending on what you're looking for, a different keyboard can have different results for different people. But if you want to talk about maintaining a keyboard, the best thing to do is to avoid eating and drinking around it and to periodically do some maintenance on it. Like I said, by popping off keys, you can even wipe it down with a slightly damp cloth or a paper towel, of course with the computer turned off, and that can remove any stickiness from it that may have been transferred from your hands or other people that were using it. So it's a great question. My answer to it is a Kensington K64365. Like I said, that seems to work well for me, but as always, your mileage may vary. So thank you to Krista for that. And last but not least, in the Q&A section for this week's podcast, Nick writes in, and Nick asks about what type of printer I would recommend for non-photo use. And this also is a really great question. Thanks a lot, Nick, because this is something that I don't really hear people talking about inside of photography. We don't really talk about non-photography subjects inside the overall category of photography, but we do have non-photography needs that we always need to address, and sometimes there can be a blending line, and you really don't want to print out that PowerPoint presentation or that Excel spreadsheet or that email on that $600 printer or that $700 printer where your inks and your paper are pretty expensive. So what do you use? Well, and there's a lot of options out there, and it really depends on your consumption. So if you're going to be doing just a little bit of printing per month in these types of office-type environments where you're printing an email or a Word document, or an Excel document, or you just want to do something rough where you don't need a lot of detail in terms of resolution and dots per inch and DPI and all the high-end quality stuff that goes into photography. If you're doing light printing in that genre every month, I would recommend an inkjet printer. If you're doing higher than 100 sheets a month, I would recommend a laser printer. You really can't go wrong these days. The costs of both have come down so much. It's really just a matter of what will fit on your desk space. And for me, that's a big consideration or a big factor is the footprint that a printer has. For me, though, I've been using an HP DeskJet 5740 for about the past 4 or 5 years. It's got a lot of dust and old kinks on it, but it still keeps plugging away, and I use that happily. And I replaced the ink in that with refills over at Walgreens for $10 per cartridge. So that's been a worthwhile, durable printer for me for the last 4 or 5 years. I don't see it breaking on me anytime soon. And, of course, the key to anything is good maintenance. Changing out ink, sometimes using canned air and unplugging it. Sometimes running a print through even if you don't need to, just to keep the inks from drying out is always a good thing to do, too. So those are the questions this week. Once again, I'd like to thank Marcus, Krista, and Nick for sharing their questions with me. All these, again, came via email, and you're welcome to email me as well at questions@canonblogger.com or in the comments section over on the blog, www.canonblogger.com. Coming up, my final little segment will be the road tip for this week. So thanks for tuning in, and I'll be right back. And welcome back to the final segment, or the final little clip for this week's podcast series. And in this last clip, my little road tip for this week is actually to just stop. That's right, stop doing it. Stop whatever you were doing. Stop taking pictures. Stop doing your graphics or your web design or whatever your job or hobby is. We all need to take some downtime periodically. And there is no better time of year than right now to do it as we approach the holiday season. Here in the United States, this week is the occasion of Thanksgiving, where we celebrate every year and give thanks for what we have in our lives. And this really is a unique opportunity for us to just really take a break, stop all the intensity of working on our photography or our hobby or whatever we're so enthusiastic about or our work, and just take a break from all of that and enjoy some time with your families, with your friends, with your loved ones, taking a break, connecting with them, and taking some time off from whatever you devote most of your energy and attention to. And not only is this great for reconnecting with those that are actually around you all the time, but it's a great way to get new energy and new creative juices flowing. Because when you take a break for any amount of time and ideas are cropping up inside your head and you're not doing them, you can have such a flood of ideas and a flood of creativity, it will literally feel like a freight train when you come back to it after a little downtime. It's like you can't get your ideas out fast enough. And you can find renewed energy and renewed excitement. And this is what makes hobbies exciting and rewarding, by having vision and direction for expression. And sometimes the best way to get these visions and this direction is to take a break. So this kind of ties back into what Marcus was asking about how to find your creative vision and what you look for and what to do to have creative visions. And sometimes the best way really just is to stop looking for it. And it's an age-old saying, stop looking for what you seek and you will find it. And the same can be said for any number of a wide variety of things, but this could never be more true than it is with creativity and creative juices, is to just stop and take a break. So that's my road tip for the week, to just stop, take a break, enjoy the weekend. And on that note, I would like to say happy Thanksgiving to all the U.S. listeners. And to those who are outside the U.S., enjoy the weekend yourselves. I hope all your shots are good ones. Happy shooting to everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you back here next week. Have a good weekend, everyone.